to another episode of Carpool. As you possibly can tell from the quality of the light, it's either quite late at night or it's very early in the morning. Well, let me put your mind at rest. It is very early in the morning. I'm on my way to pick up a passenger today and take him to the airport. He's off to the United States to a big science fiction convention, and that might be a clue as to who the sort of area that he works in. Here we go. I'm getting very close now. So, please welcome into the passenger seat, Mr. Cory Doctorow.
Well, I'm going to go right.
I want to get that way. If you do the beginning bit,
yeah. Yeah, right and left will take you to Tot Street roundabout.
Oh, that's fine. Oh, I'll know where I'm from there. Because that's where the gap is between my, the generational gap. Mm. You know, that I grew up without computers and without computer games and as a kid, I've kind of bypassed it. I've only ever come across it as an adult.
Well, I think there's three important generations that were, or at least three important generational experiences of computers, which is the experience of becoming an adult before computers become part of daily life, the experience of getting midway through childhood before computers become part of daily life, which is my generation. There's a kind of, it's actually almost a sharp delineation, because once computers became available, they were so compelling to me and so many of my colleagues and peers that we just never let up. It became a kind of central feature of our lives.
Right.
And then there's the third generation, which is people who've always had them.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's that classic formulation, anything invented before you're 18 was there forever. Anything invented after 18 is revolutionary and brilliant. Anything invented over your 30 should be banned. So
when you were a little kid then, your parents didn't have computers in the house?
Yeah, well, it started pretty early. My dad was a computer scientist, so in 1977, when I was six, we had a teletype terminal.
That was unusual.
Right? Yeah, it was very unusual, it was not even recognizable as a computer by contemporary standards. It was a device you plugged into the phone line that had a roll of paper.
Wow.
And it chattered and rolled out text on the paper.
Right.
There was no screen.
Yeah.
And you'd type on your keyboard and it would come up on the roll of paper. And my mom was working in public elementary schools, state schools. And she could snitch home great rolls of brown paper towel from the bathroom.
Right.
And so we'd run them through in one direction and then we'd turn them over and run them through in the other direction. It is quite funny to think that there was a time when one of the limiting factors of computing was how much paper you had on hand.
Yeah.
And then in 1979, my dad, by that point, was head of computer science at a big high school in suburban Toronto in Scarborough. Right. And Apple was bringing out their first non-kit bashed personal computer, the Apple II Plus. And they were quite shrewd. They said to heads of computer science at schools, take one home for the summer and decide whether you want to integrate it into the curriculum.
Right.
And so at the time, my dad's students worked with some big PDP, I think it was a PDP 11 probably, that was off campus that they timeshared on. And computer science class involved punching cards and then running your program and then getting your output and then repunching your cards. So the experience of, and it with the gap between those would be, 4 or 5 days. And the experience of that, of having an interactive basic interpreter, let alone, being able to program an assembler and all the rest of it, was so radically transformative to the way that we understood computers, much less use them, that it was a no-brainer. So my dad bought one at the end of the summer, and we then had a string of Apple computers over many years.
Because I do remember reading about that. Someone said, you've got a tattoo. Have you still got...
I'd have to undress to show it to you. But yeah, I've got a little sad Mac on my bicep. In 1989, I was 18 years old.
Right.
And I'd had a Mac SE that I'd hand overclocked to an SE30.
That was my first Apple.
Yeah, and it was always very finicky. And it used SCSI, which was the worst ever platform for chaining up drives. And it was particularly bad because if you had a loose connect or if you disconnected a drive unexpectedly or if one drive in the chain went bad, it could corrupt the whole string.
Yeah.
And I had just a shit ton of data on it and a shit ton of old drives that I'd stuck onto it. and something went wrong and I lost everything. And I spent like maybe 10 days locked in my room in a flat share, just ordering in pizzas and smoking cartons of cigarettes and recovering my data, you know, literally bit by bit with a, a hex editor.
Right.
And when it was all back, I decided to commemorate it with a little memento mori, and I went out to a tattoo shop and had a sad Mac, which is what comes up when your Mac boots bad.
But now you're going to, so where are you? I don't even quite know where you're
going. I'm going to a World Science Fiction Convention in Reno.
In Reno, Nevada?
Yeah.
Wow.
Never been there.
Are you not? You haven't? No,
I've been to Vegas, but yeah. I've never been to Reno. Reno's not a city that a lot of people have called to go to anymore, which is why it's cheap enough to hold a Worldcon in. It's
right.
Reno's, you know, of course, famed for quickie divorce.
You could get a divorce there, yeah. Yeah.
Vegas for quickie marriage, Reno for quickie divorce.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm off to Reno.
Because that's what, I'm so envious of you in so many ways. I'm just a big ball of envy because of, you know, which is, and it's generational. I can't even blame myself for... Mm. Yeah, it's not my fault that I was born in 1956, so I was just that bit too early. So that the you know, kind of everything you've done is what I've wanted to do. I mean, I've published lots of books through publishers, you know, and all those things. But then I kept hearing about you, about in that world of like breaking the mold and challenging the perceived, you know, this is how you do it, and you know, and obviously successfully, you know, that I think that's incredible how you've, well, I don't quite know what you've done. I want to know what, I want you to tell me, because
I started sending stories to magazines when I was 16, and I started selling to the semi-professional ones when I was 17, and I really broke in with a sale to a professional market when I was 26, so 10 years later.
And
a few years after that, I'd sold enough short stories that had been well received enough that I won the Campbell Award for Best New Writer in the field, which was quite an honor, and that was in 2000.
Right.
And later that year, I sold my first novel to Tor Books, but it didn't come out until 2003, at which point there was just loads of stuff happening with ebooks. And mostly, at the time, ebooks, my editor said ebooks have the worst ratio of hours in meetings to dollars in revenue than anything publishing has ever done. And these days, Google has released beautiful optical character recognition libraries, and we have lots of great image processing for allowing you to scan books that are not despined.
Right.
So you can scan a book that's keystoned, and then you can image correct it, and then OCR it.
Wow.
So it's gotten much faster. Yeah. But in those days, I actually tried it to see what it was all about. I said, you know, like, what actually happens when a member of my audience decides he loves my book enough that he wants to make a copy available on the internet.
Yeah.
And it took me 80 hours. And, you know, I could probably whittle that down with practice to 40, but it still struck me, especially I'd done a nonfiction book before then, and it struck me that 40 hours or 80 hours was probably 40x or 80x the amount of actual individual publicity my book got from anyone at the publisher.
Yes.
So, you know, I started thinking about this and realized that, you know, copying wasn't going to get harder, that my audience only copied works because they loved them.
Yeah.
Nobody was putting 40 hours in because they hated it.
I can't stand this book.
Yeah, I'm going to scan it. I'm going to go buy another copy, cut the spine off, and scan it. You know, we don't know what to do about it to stop it. And so I reckoned, okay, so I can do three things. I can ignore it. I can embrace it. Or I can rage futilely against it. And three was kind of a non-starter. If nothing else, I figured some of the people who are involved in this production aren't doing it because it's the grand game of the internet, but because, as I say, because they love the book.
Yeah.
And so calling those people thieves, there's just no percentage in it.
No.
So, you know, because they want to buy my book. So at least let's not alienate those people. So what am I going to do? Well, I figured, you know, there's this new Creative Commons thing. I was at the time dating a woman who was the CTO of Creative Commons back then. And the licenses hadn't yet been released. I was watching her work through the license generator. And I went back to my editor and said, there's this CC thing coming along. He'd seen some of Larry Lessig's talks. And I said, it looks good to me. I figure it can't hurt. It seems like a good experiment. And I was lucky in that my editor, Patrick Nielsen Hayden, I met him when I was 17 on a BBS. and wow. he ran his own Linux boxes, and he wow. wrote his own movable type plugins, and he was the most senior editor of the largest science fiction line in the world.
Wow.
So it was like, okay, yeah, well, that, yeah, that's yeah. there's a guy who can only talk to, who can talk to just one person, the publisher, Tom Doherty, yeah. and convince him. My editor was able to talk Tom Doherty, who's a wonderful guy, into trying the experiment, and they ran 10,000 hardcovers, which was a big run yeah. for a first novel. Yeah. It was, you know, it was a first novel with a $6,800 advance, right? I mean, we're not talking right. about a giant, you know, hotly expected novel. It was yeah. just, it was your basic, modest first novel venture. Yeah. And the only thing we really did different was try this. And we tried it partly because I was doing Boing Boing, and Boing Boing at the time had about 10,000 readers a day. And so that's sort of, if all my readers bought a book, I'd be done. But, yeah. But I often, at the time, people said, oh, this Dr. O guy, he's got this blog with 10,000 readers. That's nothing. The mass market traditionally has 50, 60,000 paperbacks in it, runs in a yeah. paperback. He's got nothing to lose. Of course they're doing this with him.
Right.
He's got no following. And then, 15 years on, whenever I do an ebook release, they say, that Dr. O, he's got such a big following, he can afford to do this.
Yes. No one else can do it.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean,
yeah.
We tried it, 30,000 downloads in the first 24 hours.
Wow.
60,000 the next 24 hours. Wow. It's done, I stopped counting, but several million downloads.
Right.
It's in like 5 or 6 printings, been published in like 10 or 15 languages.
Right.
Like, it's done really well. People always said to me, what will you do when ebooks take over from print books and giving away ebooks is no longer viable? And I said, well, not giving away ebooks will never be possible. So yeah. again, I figure whatever happens, it's not going to involve coercing people into paying for your books because there's no other way to get them save paying for them.
Yeah.
It's going to involve convincing people to pay for your books. And I reckon one of the ways you convince people to do things is not looking like a dick.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so yeah. I make my books available. And so this year I decided I would try a print experiment. Do I really, really need to do a short story collection through a publisher? They're
yeah.
not. Short story collections aren't big earners.
No.
You know, they're essentially vanity projects for writers who don't want to see their short fiction disappear.
Yeah.
Let's try it. Let's try it as a real vanity project. So I did an ebook. Lots of different formats. I started it off calling it donationware, and that generated very few donations. And
yeah.
then I switched it to pay what you like, and that generated a lot of donations.
Uh-huh.
And I also put the payment box on the page you downloaded it from, and I can't believe I was stupid enough not to have a little PayPal box on that page.
Right.
I had a download page and a donate page, and again,
right.
massive difference, lesson yeah. learned, which is good. I did a print edition through Lulu, and then expanded that through a lot of the other print-on-demand services.
Right.
My friend John Barry, who'd laid out one of my essay collections, and is something like head of typography at Microsoft, and is a really widely loved typographer. He
right.
He's married to a great science fiction writer named Eileen Gunn, and when we were all in Japan for the World Science Fiction Convention in Yokohama, Eileen was sadly neglected while John was mobbed by typographers who just worshipped his work. So so John, you know, very graciously agreed to type set up. And I called it With a Little Help, because I figured, you know, I could only do this with help from
yes.
other people. I tapped four cover artists I knew and paid them whatever they wanted. In one case it was zero, in some cases it was royalties, in some cases cash and royalties.
Right.
Whatever they wanted for covers, had the covers done.
I love your covers too.
Yeah, they're quite good. It's yeah. funny, because the one that I wasn't charging any money for is the only one that sells worth a damn.
Wow.
And it's the one that's mostly type.
Right, yeah.
And then I did a hardcover, a bespoke hardcover. I went into Old Acres Printers, old, you know, multi-century old family
right.
printer in Hatton Garden, and had them do some beautiful printings. And then I took the signatures down to down the road in Clerkenwell to Wyvern Bindery, which is another family-owned business in you know, Clerkenwell, beating part of the Industrial Revolution
yes.
there. And he did a beautiful binding, and we stamped the number on the spine. We're doing a run of 275. I'm up to about 100 copies now. And I sold them for $275 each.
Wow.
Run of 250s, so sold them $275 each. Each one comes with a SD card set into the cover with a blob of blue tack that's got all the audio. So I asked all my voice actor friends to record the audio. And then I also made the audio available as a pay what you like download and as a CD through Lulu.
Right.
And I wrote to all of my writer friends and I said, I'd just been going through my file cabinet to clear some stuff out. There was all this stuff that, for lack of a better word, was like sentimental paper.
Right.
It was just stuff that felt like, it felt somehow collectible, but yeah. I had no actual reason for owning it. I just didn't want to throw it away. So I wrote to them and I said, have you got anything like this? Because I'm going to use them for the end papers. Right. So I'm just going to get, you know, 70, 80, 100 writers, just random stuff, grocery lists and editorial notes and what have you. Wow. And I'm going to, I want you to sign them, write what it is, and I'm going to bind them in as the end papers.
Right.
And they did. And I got galleys, I got rejection letters, I got Jay Lake's cancer diagnosis, I got Nello Hopkinson's formal bankruptcy filing.
Then each book then is totally different. Only one of them is going to have of those things.
Yeah, and they each one pays me about 150 net, not counting my labor.
Right.
So they're good earners.
Yeah.
And then what I did was, because it's print on demand, I said, okay, well, it's going to have typos, and I got my mum to proof it. She's proofed all my books. She's always caught stuff the subs didn't catch and that I didn't catch. So I got her to proof it. She found a whack of typos that I fixed. And then I said, there's still going to be typos in this because there's always typos in it. Yeah. It's print on demand. I can change the book between printings, between copies. So if you find a typo, send it to me. I'll change it the day you send it to me, and I'll give you a footnote on the page. Right. And you can buy a copy of the book with your name in it. And I did.
Wow.
Patched about 150 bugs, I guess. And they've trickled off to almost nothing.
Yeah.
It's really funny because every time, you know, 3 weeks go by, 4 weeks go by without a typo, I think that's it, we're done.
Yeah.
And then someone finds not just a typo, but generally a really obvious typo.
Isn't it extraordinary?
And it's really amazing.
Yeah, how it'll jump out to someone.
Yeah. I am prepared to say that at some point, I might have published the world's typo-free book, but I'm not positive.
Because it must freak a lot of publishers out. I mean, I think there's going to be... I think my, you know, people that I'm involved with in that world are going to watch this.
I guess, they will. They will. I mean, it's sometimes it confirms their biases, and sometimes it challenges their thinking.
Yeah.
I think that publishers, if they're honest with themselves, and I know lots of them who are, will say that the most disruptive impact of the internet has not been pirate ebooks. It's been Amazon. And it's been Walmart, because Walmart is a creature of the internet. The reason you can manage a supply chain that starts in Guangzhou and ends with a nationwide chain that pivots, you know, like a ballet dancer every time the wind changes is because of the internet, because of IT. So those are the two most disruptive forces in publishing. In publishing especially, the mass market has been destroyed by Walmart, not because of Walmart's price cutting, which is yet another issue, and of course here we've got the 3-for-2 deals and so on, but because America used to have 400 regional distributors, and they did the mass market sales to chemists and grocers.
Right.
And those Teamsters, because they had job security and because they were there for long periods and because they had to haul away the books that didn't sell, got really good at working out what to put where.
Right.
So my editor bought his first science fiction novel, a copy of Dahlgren by Samuel Delaney, which is this, you know, high literary, new wave science fiction novel that features sex with dolphins. Bought it as a teenager from a pharmacy in suburban Phoenix.
Right.
You know, this is how diverse the titles were out of the bookshops.
Yeah.
And of course, the way you learn that you're a book lover is not by going into a bookshop. You go into a bookshop once you are a book lover.
Yes.
Yeah. The way you learn you're a book lover is by buying a book somewhere else.
Yeah.
And when nationwide chains became increasingly powerful, they demanded single nationwide distributors. Right. They were going to have 400 suppliers.
Yeah.
And within the space of a few years, America was down to 4 or 5 suppliers, and the Midlist had totally collapsed.
Right.
And then, 10, 15 years later, the new readers that you would expect to come in behind the current generation of readers just weren't there.
Right.
Because while it was viable from Walmart's perspective to just have 100 titles nationwide featured outside of bookstores, it didn't capture that new cohort of hardcore book a day readers that were the bread and butter of the bookstores and of the publishers.
Yeah.
And so if they're honest, they're going to say, well, piracy is a distraction. You know, the real things that we need to contend with, for example, in ebooks, is the fact that many of the publishers now have or ebook vendors have non-negotiable DRM policies that lock our books into their formats, and it's illegal for us to authorize our readers to break the DRM and go to a better supplier if we change suppliers anytime in the future. And every time we sell a book that's got DRM on it from Amazon or Apple or Sony, it makes it harder for us to change the deal with Amazon, Apple, or Sony, and easier for them to change the deal.
Right.
Easier for them to come back and require a larger margin. Because if Amazon comes back and says, "Right, we don't want 30%, we want 40%," we can't say, "Fine, we're leaving Amazon," because the minute you do, the tens of millions of aggregate dollars spent on your books by millions of readers suddenly become a liability because they can't. They have to abandon them to go to the next platform.
I am overwhelmed. And then I realise that there is a mess. I'm leaving. There's a sort of wake, a digital wake behind me, which I just... there's lots of stuff I really want to know about, really want to see, really want to understand. And it's just... it's just too much. Now, I'm just wondering whether that's a generational thing that I go... that I've now started to go, I can't see any of that. I just can't take it in.
So, I think that there was a time when we relied on knowledge of specifics to navigate our way through the world. You had to know the route from A to B.
Yeah.
You needed to know everything, every step of the process to manufacture a car or, you know, beat out a sword on your anvil.
Yeah.
You needed to know all this stuff, or you needed to have the raw knowledge to figure out solutions more or less on your own. And I don't think that that's the case anymore. I think now we live in a world where what you need to know is the narrative of how something works so that you can generate search terms that you can plug into Google to figure out how to do it when you get there.
Yes.
And I remember this great poem, "The old crow knows where to go, the young crow does not." No, "The old crow is getting slow, the young crow is not. The one thing that the old crow knows is where to go."
Right.
And we have a kind of reversal now, almost, or not necessarily, but we have... we have this thing now among young people that you can find out where to go at the turn of a page.
Really. Yeah, you can.
And so, you know, I read this novel Little Brother, which is a kind of radical novel for young people about kids who take over the government in America to restore the Bill of Rights after the Department of Homeland Security's anti-terror crackdown against too much. They wage a guerrilla war against America. And it has some things that read like recipes for building revolutionary technology, but they're not everything you need to know. They're everything you need to know to find out everything you need to know.
Right.
They're just the search terms.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I worry about when we see kind of lockdown platforms is if there's no exposed rough edge, if there's nothing that implies you could go to Google and find out how to do more, then that bit of the experience falls away from the device.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that the successful navigational technique in the 21st century is to stop trying to read everything.
Yeah.
Stop trying to understand everything, but get enough of the gist that when the moment comes that you need to synthesize more stuff into one piece and sit down and do a deep dive into it, you know what the search terms are. And that's what blogging does for me. Blogging, by writing up brief blurbs about articles that I've read briefly, the expression of what's caught your interest for a third party requires you to sharpen it in your own mind.
Yes.
It makes it mnemonic.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what I do with Boing Boing, and that's, you know, one of the ways that I write is that every now and again a bunch of disparate things seem to cohere.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and then I have notes on them in Boing Boing.
Yeah.
And I go and I reread my notes and then sit down to compose.
Yes, yes. No, I'm with you there. I mean, that's absolutely it. Because one of the things I've realized recently, and again with my wife, was searching for something on Google. That because I've done it so much, so almost obsessively, then I realized as I was doing it with her, the speed and the way that my brain now goes, finds a way in, because that's not it, that's not what we're looking for,
it's
around that way, and I don't even know, and it's only because she was watching, going, she kept saying, "What are you doing?"
Absolutely.
And I say, "No, you're not going to find it if you just, how do you, you know, let's go this way, and I'll find," and then you find a link, and you follow that link, and that stuff, then you realize that is actually an intellectual skill that there's no way my teachers or university professors or anyone when I was 15 would have known that.
So this is why it's funny when we say, "Oh, we can close the libraries now."
Yeah.
Because librarians have always been about navigating authority and queries, not shelving books. Yeah. You know,
actually, that would have been the one group of people when I was 15 who would have understood what I was doing. It would be
librarians. Well, and talk about navigating authority, right? So librarians have always been at the coalface of the fire hose, depending on your narrative. They've been sat there, you know, with every book in the world clamoring for their attention. They've chosen ones that they thought were authoritative. Yeah. And that's what you do when you sit down and you run a query, is you've got all these search results and you have to figure out what's authoritative.
Yeah.
And, you know, the heuristic that we used to be able to use was that it's between covers. Someone took the time to invest in publication. It's probably authoritative. Of course, that was never true. I mean, Mein Kampf was between covers. But it was kind of truthy enough that it got away with it for a long time, and I kind of celebrate the fact that we've finally recognized that not everything true is between covers, and not everything between covers is true.
Yes, yes. I pull over there. Sorry,
I'm just over here. This is it.
Yep. All right. Oh, well, well done, Corey. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
No, really good. And now you're actually. Well, you're not late, which is because I was slightly anxious that we get stuck in really bad traffic.
No, I reckon it'll be an hour at this time. I'm kind of an old hand at this.
So. No, you know the system. Yeah. Brilliant.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Really good.
Thank you very much.